Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with bonkers.ie, Ireland's favourite comparison and switching website. Visit bonkers.ie today and start saving on your household bills.
1850 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. 51551 is our text number. Now back to promises either before the election or during the election. Joyce Russell. Joyce, good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon, Joe.
This I'm quoting from a newspaper of nearly 2 years ago at this stage. The Taoiseach has requested the Department of Health to contact the HSE to ensure appropriate assistance is offered to Daniela as a matter of urgency. The HSE will continue to engage with Daniela in order to offer her the appropriate support and treatment. What prompted that statement from the Taoiseach's office?
Pressure from me, basically. Because we were in such a dire strait with Danielle at the time. Mm-hmm. And I felt so angry because we were not getting any support no matter what way we turned. So we did it not to gain attention, but to make awareness of the seriousness of this illness.
Anorexia
and eating disorder, yeah. To make awareness that from my family and for all the other families in this country that are suffering in silence.
Okay, well, you managed to get through because the statement reads, the Taoiseach, in February, 23rd of February 2018, it's now, we're on the cusp of February 2020 and the cusp of a general election on Saturday week. The Taoiseach has requested the Department of Health to contact the HSE to ensure appropriate assistance is offered to Daniela as a matter of urgency. What assistance did you get, Joyce, in the last 2 years?
Nothing. Absolutely nothing. We got no assistance, we got no phone call, we got no letter, nothing to say. We understand, we're there to support you. There wasn't even any mention of we'll do all we can to help you, but there was nothing. And that's what makes
The Taoiseach said on February 23, 2018, the HSE will continue to engage with Daniela in order to offer the appropriate support and treatment. Did they engage with you, the HSE?
No. The only engagement we had was in Kerry Hospital, where I couldn't thank the staff and the doctors and the nurses there. But like any hospital in Ireland, they're not trained or qualified to deal with eating disorders, nor have they got the time. They're so swamped under themselves.
So what appropriate support and treatment were you offered in the last 2 years for Daniela?
Well, we weren't, because we had to take her to England. All we were offered, like so many families here, is a psychiatric ward. And that seems to be the first protocol for this country, because, well, they're out of the way and we'll sedate them and we don't know how to cope with it, so let's put them into a psychiatric ward, which is not the answer, because people with eating disorders, as so many families in the same situation know, they need 24-hour care, they need supervision, they need reassurance, they need care, they need understanding. But one thing they do not need is shaming and blaming, which we seem to be great at doing, because we don't understand the illness. And I'm speaking on behalf of myself and other families, like listening to that couple and the lady yesterday, my heart, that's why I wanted to contact you, because I could hear the exhaustion in their voices and the hopelessness and the powerlessness. You're watching your child suffer and destroy themselves, and they can't understand their illness. You can't understand their illness. You turn to the professionals for help. You turn to your government, who you think you can trust. And every door is closed in your face and you're just told to get on with it. How can you have any hope or trust in a government that won't even give you any inclination of a little bit of hope or to say, I will try and help you? How would Simon Harris feel? Like, he has a child. I wrote a personal letter to him. How would he feel if he was in our situation? For all the families, 200,000 families in Ireland that are in the same situation as me, how would he feel looking at his child ill?
Jim Daly, the junior minister, Fine Gael, when did he make promises of more funding for treatment of people suffering from anorexia?
He made promises, in that on the prime time in 2018 when Daniela was transferred to England. And he promised at the time there would be so much money invested and the numbers would be decreased.
Okay, as you say, you had to transfer it to England. Did a HSE pay any of that cost?
No.
Why are you laughing nearly?
Because by then I had given up hope, and it was a case of if my daughter stayed here, she would die, or I'd take her to England to help her survive.
And who paid for it? She was an inpatient in England somewhere.
She was, yes, yeah. She was, I mean, unfortunately, she's been in 4 units now, and she was in London for a year through the HS or the NHS.
Okay.
And then she was in Cambridge for a year after that. She was very fortunate that she was born in England.
Okay, I take that point.
That's why.
Yeah, okay, so where, yeah. Did the HSE make any contribution, say, for you to go back and forward to see your daughter?
No. And at that stage, like so many families will tell you, you just give up because you're trying to live day to day to help your child survive.
Yeah,
you'll do anything.
I know. And a statement from the HSE this week about the case of Paula. Paula Walsh and her parents, David and Susanna, contacted us in Lois Bridges.
Yeah.
Obviously, to say this pro forma thing, you can't comment on individual, that's understandable, I suppose. General GDPR. But they say the HSE can say most people with eating disorders recover through treatment in their community. All adults who have an eating disorder can be admitted to inpatient mental health approved centres around the country. There are three
can
beds.
Can I stop you there, Joe?
Okay.
Sorry to interrupt you.
Of course, yeah.
Can I stop you? They can be admitted to places around the country. They can have community support. Number one, there is no units. Number two, there is no community support. For instance, my daughter, Daniela, she's on a 2.5-year waiting list to see a psychologist in Kerry. She has to go to Cork once a week, which I take her to. So there are no facilities. That's false promises to start with. So that's lies from the HSE. Absolute rubbish. If that was the case, we wouldn't have the numbers we would have now. We wouldn't have families in desperation like we have now. Our families exhausted and burnt out. And sisters and brothers that are so confused looking at their other sibling just destroying themselves, and they don't understand why. And this is what our government don't get, and the HSE. Families need support so much. Whatever way we're feeling, we've got to get on, get up every day and reassure our child things will get better. How can you do that when there is nobody there to support a family?
The HSE statement goes on, there are 3 beds in St. Vincent's Hospital in Dublin, I presume, ring fence for people with eating disorders.
3 beds and we have 200,000 in the country.
The HSE does fund patients in private facilities, they say.
No, it doesn't. I went for funding like that family in Lewis Bridges. I tried 3 times to get funding for Lewis Bridges and I was told no, like that family, my daughter wasn't ill enough. You're telling somebody with an eating disorder they're not ill enough. You're telling their eating disorder they're not ill enough. So, and you have a country that won't help them. So, of course, that person is going to get worse and the family are standing by looking at this. We need people to be educated on eating disorders. We need it to be done in schools. Me as a parent, I was clueless to what anorexia was when Daniela diagnosed. I had no idea. So surely early intervention is vital. And then we wouldn't have the situation that we have now where there are no units. If we have early intervention, we wouldn't have waiting lists like we have now. We wouldn't have heartbroken families. People do recover from eating disorders,
yes,
but people also die from it.
Yeah, but
and I have seen people die from it.
And we've seen people recover with proper treatment.
With proper treatment.
Programs
and it's like also, Joe, the aftercare is vital.
Yeah, you hear.
It's so vital. And that isn't there. I mean, the only support my daughter is at the moment is me and her GP and the psychologist she goes to see in Cork. Without that, she will relapse and she will tell you that herself.
Well, you heard Anne yesterday. Well, there's been Anne yesterday. Her daughter Ella, 15, has anorexia. Has had it for a while. Can't get onto one of these programs, but she is in a hospital at the moment where she is being force-fed. That is the only. But have a quick listen. It's 15 seconds from Anne yesterday.
My daughter's crying, begging me, "Mammy, please, please, I just want my life back. I don't know where else to turn, Joe, and I'm begging somebody to help me here with my child. I want the proper help for her, but somebody has to save her life."
The Taoiseach has requested the Department of Health to contact the HSE to ensure appropriate assistance is offered to Daniela, your daughter, Joyce, as happened, as a matter of urgency. The HSE will continue to engage with Daniela in order to offer appropriate support and treatment. You said none of that happened. She had to go to England and the HSE didn't spend a penny on that trip, either in terms of the treatment or in terms of all the ancillary costs as well. And that's a promise made in the Sun, as quote in the Sun newspaper, 23rd of February 2018. And you also sent us in a quote from Primetime, where the junior minister, Jim Daly, said promised more funding. And that was 2 years ago as well. And it looks like, if we listen to what's happening in the real world yesterday, real lives, real people talking about what's happening now, instead of platitudes dressed up as profundities and in leaders' debates and leaders' this and leaders coming out your ear, nose and throat at this stage, and they're all making promises. But let's find out how they operate in the real world. Lisa, good afternoon, Lisa.
Hi, Joe, how are you?
How are you? You, as you say, you struggled with anorexia since you were 16.
Yeah, I did. And I still struggle with it. And when I hear about that mother with Daniela, it's desperately sad, but she is amazing. As somebody who has an eating disorder, she should be so proud of herself for fighting very hard for her daughter. And I do think it's falling. I think the state have a lot to answer for in regards to help for mental health in general, not alone anorexia, which is highly unheard of, but... And how, I'm sorry, I'm a bit nervous.
Take your time.
And how they treat anorexia and how little is known in general about the treatment in recovery. I feel myself as somebody who battles it daily. I am in recovery. I'm a hell of a lot better than I was, for definite. I'm happier about life in general.
Yes.
I do get bad days. I do get bad times in my life, but I have coping strategies that I have to put in place. And if they aren't put in place, then all hell breaks loose. I still attend a counsellor every day within my community, like that lady was saying, but only because I fought for that. That wasn't just handed out to me. And like that lady was saying with her daughter, Daniela, I was checked into mental health wards in Ennis. They couldn't do anything with me. My weight wasn't low enough. I was checked into the regional in Limerick, waiting ages on gurneys for them to tell me, your weight isn't low enough. Until my weight did get so low, then they were like, we can't treat you. So you just get this complete backwash of, we do not know what to do with you. Your illness, your mental illness, we have no idea how to treat it. That is the response from the professionals. They don't know. The only best advice I ever got was from a psychologist whom I saw, and I waited on a waiting list for ages to see, who was in Limerick. And she was a trainee psychologist, and she was amazing. And she said to me, the one thing I can tell you is your eating disorder will never leave you. Now, if you tell an eating disorder person that, they love it. They go, okay, good, that's great. I don't have to surrender anything. Woohoo, I'm free. But then she says, but your eating disorder will eventually take a backseat. It won't be all-encompassing. You'll realise outside the eating disorder, there are cool things. There are friends. There's music. There's laughing. There's going to learn how to swim. There's taking part in society again, putting yourself out there, meeting new people, meeting salads, going out to nightclubs, dancing. You know, having a life again doesn't revolve around food, around restricting, around punishing yourself.
And as you say, Lisa, you were offered these a bed in a mental health facility, which was not specifically to deal with anorexia. Lisa, offered one of these three beds in St. Vincent's Hospital that are ring-fenced for people with eating disorders?
No, but I know of people who are, and it is like a situation where you go in, you get fed up, as in they refeed you. And then they come back out and they're well for a certain period of time and then they go back in. It's a very hard condition to break the cycle of. It's like an addiction, but it's not like an addiction, because if you're in addiction, you stop. You stop drinking, you stop smoking, you stop gambling, you stop sex, you stop whatever the addiction is. When you have an eating disorder, you can't stop eating. You can restrict, even people with eating disorders can't stop eating indefinitely. They can't, because they can't sleep, they can't function. So eventually they will eat. So what they eat isn't enough to sustain them, obviously. Mm-hmm. But they will eventually eat. But it's that whole thing of what comes with that, that control, and it's just a coping strategy. That's all this boils down to, is it's a coping strategy for anxiety, for depression, for worry, for rejection, for not feeling good enough, for not feeling accomplished enough, for not feeling like their peers, for being bullied in school, for whatever has happened when they were younger that might have affected them in later life. Like, this is what eating disorders are. They're just coping tools. And when you demystify yourself from that and you take a step back and you go, I'm going back into this cycle because I can't cope with whatever this is that is too stressful for me. Mm. And you start to realize your limitations. You start to only take on what you can take out, and you find out meditation works for me. Getting back into nature works for me. Mm-hmm. Listening to my music, singing in the car really badly, listening to Joe Duffy. Like, whatever cheers me up on a Friday.
Lisa, you know, sorry, can I interrupt you there? Sorry. Yeah. I just want to thank you so much for having the courage for coming on, and thank you for saying what you said. You saying what you were saying is helping, and I can recognise a lot of what you were saying. Like, your eating disorder is always going to be there with you, and Daniela will say that to me, and there is this thing in society, and I did it myself as a parent, you want to fix the person with an eating disorder. You can't do that. It's part of them. And everything you're saying there is so, so encouraging. And it's wonderful. Yeah. And you need the support and encouragement from people to help you feel like that. And like you say, being bullied, being all the side effects of it, that all goes so unrecognized. And it's, I mean, you're a huge inspiration for what you're saying. And like, and it's so important people understand every day is, it's day by day, and it's not something that's going to go away because people say, oh, you know, you're better now, you're fine. You never, it's like any illness.
No,
you cope with it from day to day.
And remember,
that's the other thing I really want to say to everybody listening today. If you know of somebody who has an eating disorder, do not comment on their weight.
Absolutely.
Regardless of if they're underweight or if they've gained weight, do not say you look well. Do not say any of that. Get away from that. Say you look happy. You look less stressed. You look like you slept well. All those things are the most vital and important things to live in day to day for every individual. And they're the things that are the most important things to make a happy human. Other than that, all the rest of your physicality in real human daily life, they're irrelevant. Nobody really, really cares because people are selfish. They care mostly about themselves. They don't care about what you look like. And when you're in the throes of an eating disorder, all you think is that people care how you appear, what you look like, how skinny you are. And I want to just add to the mammy of Daniela, okay?
The
families have so much to deal with in eating disorders. My older sisters, it encompassed all their life. My mom had to deal with so much misery from me in regards to it. She dealt with the eating disorder herself, as in me. She felt, like you said, she wanted to fix everything. She wanted to control it, to try and help me, to save it. And it's still, even now as a 33-year-old, she jumps into that mode because she just wants to protect everything in the best possible way, not in a negative way, in a way that she's trying to be helpful. And the same with my dad. He was just my best buddy. I could come to him with anything, and I made him so sad with my eating disorder. And to think, because he died suddenly last year, of all the times he was there and he listened, and that's the biggest thing as parents, if you just listen.
But that wasn't your fault, Lisa. That, you know, you can't blame yourself.
Oh, no,
you didn't
know
your own mind at the time.
Exactly. And he was an amazing dad. He was the best dad anyone could ever ask for. But the fact that you're a mother and you're listening to Daniela and you're giving her time and you're trying your best to understand her, that's so important. And when she gets better, and she will get better, she will, if she sees a life outside of it and realizes that her eating disorder isn't her identity, she'll realize how amazing you are as a person and how cool you are. And she'll still fight with you, because I still fight with my mother. I love her, but I still fight with her.
I fight too.
And you'll be best buds. You'll be best buds again.
Lisa, just to remind listeners that The first call we got was from Paula and our parents subsequently. Well, Paula initially, who's in this dedicated eating disorder facility, which I hadn't heard of until Monday. It's called Lois Bridges. It's a house in Sutton in North Dublin in Howth. I think it caters for around 9 or 10, I presume.
It is, yeah. And I've been there, Joe. Sorry to interrupt you again. And it is lovely, but again, it's private. But not only is it private, you were told you can go there for 40 days. You have funding for 40 days. And after 40 days, regardless of whether you're in the process of moving forward or there's a refeeding syndrome, which is vital as well and very dangerous if dealt with in the wrong way, it doesn't matter. After 40 days, you're out of there because after that, you have no funding. So again, that's so misunderstood. Paula's
plea was that they, so far, her family have spent 25,000 euros.
Yeah.
And they're getting no funding. Lisa, by the way, Lisa, how did you? I don't want the full details. You know, I don't want any numbers. You know that or weight or anything like that. But how did you end up in A&E?
I ended up there twice. I mean, it's been a really long road for me in general, where my weight has just fluctuated up and down and my body has given out. I passed out when I tried to reintegrate myself into the workforce after going for a few years not being able to work from being too low of a weight and taking on too much in a job that wasn't suited for me at the time a few years ago. And I passed out and I went in, and really the ambulance drivers knew by looking at me I hadn't eaten enough. And they knew. They just said it to me. There was a lovely man, and he had trained only recently. He'd done a course on mental health. And he said, look, I think you need to go and see a counsellor again. And he was so kind. He gave me so much time. Like, the one thing I will say about all the staff, like that lady was saying, is they all try their best with you. They try to give you as much as they can. Like, they try their very, very best to help. And sometimes they just can't. They're not able to. They're overrun. They're overworked. Yeah. The staff that I'm seeing out in the outpatient clinic or the day hospital clinic in Shannon, my counsellor Louise, they're overrun as well with people coming in and out. And they're lovely, absolutely lovely. And they give you anything to help you. They've told me when I felt very bad with grief from losing my dad, to just come down whenever I wanted to just drop in and talk to them.
Brilliant.
Just absolutely, and they don't have to be like that. And they're always texting me to make sure, you know, are you okay for coming in? Because I was forgetting times. They just understood everything to do with it. But at the same time, they'd also tell you, as eating disorders go, we don't know how to treat them. Like, I've had counsellors say that to my face. We do not know how to treat an eating disorder. We can put you on a waiting list and you might be waiting up to 4 or 5 years to see a psychologist again. Like, I was told that only last month. And they said that was the way to go. There was nothing wrong with doing that, but they felt that the best way to see somebody sooner was to pay for it.
Yeah.
And then to continue to pay for it. But I think the only thing I found that helped me was the psychologist. I think the treatment centres, I went to a very good treatment centre up in Dublin, and like you said, I paid for most of it. My family did.
Yeah.
It was the Merino, and they were quite good, but they were very expensive.
Yeah, they're very
and
expensive.
I was going...
Okay.
Yeah, and I was going up and down as
Lisa,
well.
Lisa, you have incredible insight into the condition.
That's because I went through it all.
I know, but you're incredible. But Lisa, remember, Joyce's hurt, apart from the distress that Daniela is going through, and as you say, the toll it takes on the family, is that 2 years ago she got a statement from the Taoiseach of this country saying the Taoiseach has requested the Department of Health to contact the HSE to ensure appropriate assistance is offered to Daniela as a matter of urgency.
Absolutely.
Joyce, what has happened since the Taoiseach made that statement?
Nothing, not a thing, and that's why I fight for every family in this country.
Okay, 51551. Jane, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe.
How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Okay, can I start with Lowe's Bridges, this facility in the north side of Dublin, which is specifically for eating disorders?
Yeah.
Now, you went there for 3 months.
Yeah, I went in June this year and finished up in August. Now, again, obviously, it's private, but I had healthcare.
Did the HSE pay for it, or was it VHI or
Leia? No, it was Leia.
Leia, okay.
Now, again, Leah, only give you, they were only initially giving me 6 weeks.
Yeah.
And
40 days.
And I suppose, well, I thought I wasn't going to last 40 minutes, Joe, to be honest. I was packing my bags every 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. And I came to the point where 6 weeks was when I had gotten strong enough, when I started refeeding my brain, I suppose, and I could concentrate and I could see things clearer. I was like, okay, I actually need the extra 6 weeks.
Okay.
I had gotten over, well, after a long stretch and battle and severe torment, should I say, but I had gotten over the eating part, the having the three meals, the having the three snacks. So I, in my own little world, was like, sure, I'm fine now, I'm eating. And then I had a word with myself one night, and I said, Kiona, this happened before. Where I was like, oh, I'm fine, I'm able to eat. But then it just clicked with me. And it was like, no, I need these extra 6 weeks. I was okay to the point where I was eating. Mm-hmm. But, and can I say keeping it down? Because my main problem was I was severe bulimia.
Okay.
Severe bulimia. It was to the point where I might need something all day, and then it could go for 8 to 9 hours a night, every night, of eating and just purging, eating and purging.
Okay.
So I suppose I had kept myself to, yes, I was underweight, but I kept myself within, you keep yourself within that weight range where I suppose, look, I was in denial. I mean, everyone knew I had an eating disorder, but to their view of things was I wasn't eating, as whereas they never knew the actual depth of it. So after the 6 weeks, I knew that it was mental issues that I had to target. It was underlying issues. It was to why. It was to all the reasoning. I sent Leah an email, and I basically pleaded with them to give me an extension to stay. And they got back to me within 2 days, and they said that, look, they had granted my...
Wow.
Yeah, I had told them that there was a high risk that I was going to relapse, and I just wanted my life back. I wanted to be able to go for meals. I wanted to be able to eat.
Yeah.
I wanted to be able to sit down with my family every Saturday evening rather than run out of the house because I smelled food, because I couldn't tolerate it. I wanted to be able to cook for myself. I wanted to be able to do all these things.
Well, one fair play to Leah. I know they're a private company, but still, it's an insurance company.
It's an absolute joke. Listening to Lisa there, I think Lisa took every word that I wanted to say because she sounds absolutely amazing, but I can understand her 110%.
And Jane, previously to Lois Bridges, and I'll talk about Lois Bridges after the break, but previously had you had any admissions to state or other private facilities for your eating disorder?
I admitted myself to John of God's in 2010. First of all, I'm 39, I'm suffering since I was 21.
Okay.
It did start off as anorexia. It was actually started off as a diet for my 21st. And I suppose I did reach out to the HSE after a number of years. I can't remember what age I was. I think I was 24, 25. And when I was put into their care and given an appointment to see a psychiatrist up in the outpatient in Galway, now it was a young doctor. It was a young coloured doctor. And his words were, "Hi, how are you? And then what can I do for you?" I mean, you have a 24-year-old girl who's going in with her head absolutely all over the place and doesn't know herself anymore. And then I explained to him, which was a very hard thing for me to do, to actually get them words out because it was a part of itself. It was admittance. And he turned around to me and he said, "So what's that?" And I went, "Sorry?" And he said, "Well, what's bulimia? What does bulimia do? What is it?" And I actually didn't know what way to turn, and I kind of got a bit mad. I won't repeat what I said.
I don't blame you. Good for you.
God knows what would have come out of my mouth. But it just went on. And then I just said, actually, are you a psychologist here or are you just an intern or sub? And he said, oh, no, I'm a doctor. And I said, well, I am... Jane, it was nice to meet you, but see you later. And I walked out the door, and I didn't go back. And then my addiction got worse and worse. My mental state got worse. Everything got worse. Because, I mean, you have people up here who are supposed to be psychologists and dealing in mental health. An eating disorder is a mental issue, whether people want to downsize it, cap it.
Of course. And when you self-admitted to John of God's, the facility, I presume, in Dublin, did they say we can specifically deal with eating disorders?
Well, they did, they did. There is a top floor. The fifth floor is actually all for addiction. So there's like drugs in one side, drink in the other side. There's also people that are addicted to paracetamol. There was a woman there that she was addicted to morphine. Yeah. And Lord rest her, but she actually committed suicide a couple of months after.
And how did you get on in that facility?
I got on brilliant and I did. I faced my biggest fear as a young girl in her 20s. I can't remember. I cried so much. I didn't sleep for 3 days. I cried, I kicked, I screamed, all everything that goes with it. But looking back now, and with the support and the help that I got in Lewis Bridges, there was no support in John of God's. They fed you. But there's no support. There's no family therapy. There's no one-to-one counselling sessions. There is no psychologist. There's nothing.
Did who paid for John of God? Do you have to pay for that yourself or your health insurance company?
No, my health insurance paid for it. I was actually with... I was just
Viva or VHI. Okay. But Jen, at any stage, and I'll ask the other, I know the answer from Joyce. She said no, despite the promises a Taoiseach made 2 years ago. But at any stage, Jane, in any of your treatment for this mental health condition, did you get any support from the state in terms of you're in Lewis Bridges?
No. I was released back into my psychologist here in Galway. I was released back into her care from Lewis Bridges, and now I'm actually in the middle of fighting because I had seen that woman before, and she's absolutely amazing. But now they're taking me out of her care, and I have to try and fight because of a change of address.
Joe. You're given like 10 sessions with psychologists. You're given like these tiny, minute amounts of treatment that aren't good enough what you're saying, Jen. Like, it's all not good enough. I myself have wrote angry emails to Simon Harris, and he's gotten back to me, not him, but people behalf have gotten back to me. But not to that extent that Daniela's mom was saying, where they promised that they'd give me help and they didn't give me anything. Now, my dad was mad into politics and he loved listening to your show, and he'd be going, what are you at, like, talking to those idiots? They're not going to do anything for you, when I'd be getting all high and mighty about my angry email. And in reality, there was parts of him saying that he was just trying to prepare me for whatever I was going to get. I was going to have to fight tooth and nail for, saying, Jen. Like, you to fight for the help, and that's the way it's got. And it's not a good place to be, because if you're very unwell and you don't have a mother as good as Daniela's mama, you don't have those people in your corner that are prepared to fight for you. It's an uphill battle. You're not going to win. You're going to die. It's as simple as that.
As well, Lisa, like, families get so exhausted. I suppose it was me, because I was strong-willed. That's why I'm still fighting, because, like, both of you are saying, you go to a session and you can be there 10 weeks and then you go in and there's a different psychiatrist or psychologist. For people with eating disorders, to step through that door is enough, and to have something screaming in your head and you're going in to build a trust with somebody and ask you, what can I do to help you as a person? People with eating disorders are not just an illness like anybody else. They are people. They have feelings. They have. They're not at fault. There is this stigma with eating disorders. Oh, they're looking for attention. Oh, come on, just eat up. It is so. I mean, yeah. They have the highest mortality rate in mental health.
Okay,
it's like all the side effects that come with eating disorders, like OCD,
GPs aren't trained in nutrition. There's a really good woman you should look up on the internet called Hazel Wallace. She's called the food medic. And she's a qualified GP and she's working for the NHS, but she's from Kildare or Meath. And Ray Darcy's had her on a load of times. And she went back and she studied dietitians and personal training. And she even says herself, the lack of amount of information put on doctors about eating disorders, about nutrition. It's very little. You don't cover a lot as a GP.
It's all based on the weighing scales. You put somebody with an eating disorder in the weighing scales. Whether, as Daniela says to me, it doesn't matter, Mum, whether your weight is up or down. Your head is going to drive you crazy no matter what. Yeah.
Okay, Joyce, Jane and Lisa, say what is 51551.
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
And Joe at rt.ie in 51551 is our text number. Maureen Fleming, sorry for holding you, Maureen. Your situation, please, and the state response.
My situation is that my daughter has had an eating disorder for the last 6 years. Mm-hmm. She's 21 now and her BMI is at 14.9. And it's quite low. She's had two inpatient treatments which have helped her slightly, but the situation with me is now that I'm not working and I can't work because I'm giving her full-time care 24 hours because I have to supervise all her meals, all her snacks, distraction after eating, because of the guilt and anxiety from eating, and as well as that, making sure she doesn't over-exercise to lose any weight she has put on, you know.
And what state help have you got, Maureen?
Well, I've applied for the carer's allowance on two occasions, and I've just got a letter back again this morning to say that they don't consider anorexia for full-time care and attention as set out in section 179 of the Social Welfare Act, you know. But she needs a lot of help as well to logic out irrational thoughts around food and fear of putting on in weight, you know. And
I know it's a full time, but to come back, what help has your daughter got from the state? Has she got any inpatient treatment? Has she got
She was in Lowe's Bridges on two occasions.
And did the state pay? The state did pay for
the HSE. Second one. Yeah.
The HSE,
Didn't. The first one, they didn't. That was through the VHI, but we didn't have full cover, so we did have to pay. For that, we'd pay about 14,000 ourselves,
And then the second time you applied to the HSE?
Yeah, and we got it through the HSE.
And insofar as you know, what made a difference? What persuaded the HSE?
I don't know, because we were attending a Curran clinic here in Swords and the site. We got it through the psychiatrist there because we had paid out, I think, so much the first time.
Okay, so he or she pleaded on your behalf to the HSC.
Yeah, exactly. So,
and now you say you've asked for financial help in running the household, so to speak, and trying.
Because
she needs 24-hour care.
For our care, yes, she does. Because, like, if I'm not here, that's part of such a secretive illness. Yeah. She tends to, she'd say she'd had eaten her lunch, and you know, if I came back, she'd probably only have eaten half.
So what you're saying is, can I have some help in having someone in the house? All of the time.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's the problem.
Through a care package, which it's not inpatient, and I know it's all money, but in terms of what the carers are paid, it's probably the least expensive package that's available.
Yeah.
If you follow me.
So
they said to you when you applied that eating disorders doesn't come into the.
It says here, to qualify for carer's allowance, the care recipient must have a disability that meets the full-time care and attention requirements as set out in Section 179 of the Social Welfare Consolidation Act, you know. But then they said, having examined the evidence provided, they, in their opinion, that she does not meet the full-time care and attention requirements as stated, you know. Because I don't think they fully understand anorexia, you know, and that she needs the support here at home, you know, for to be able to. She has come a good bit now.
Great,
I think she's
great.
Kind of halfway,
into the
recovery, and she's, because she's a bit older, she understands it a bit better now. She's 21, and she really wants a recovery. But like, we've had counselling over the years. I've had about 6 different counsellors. And all private, but they really didn't have any experience in counselling somebody with an eating disorder. And I think that's what's wrong with the country at the moment. They don't really understand it. Like, when she was first diagnosed and we went to the doctor, again, like your other callers, I didn't really know a lot about eating disorders, and the doctor just told me all she needs to do is go home and eat chocolate and ice cream. That's what I thought. I thought it was an easy, you know, this was only something simple. I never realised it was so complex.
Has Paula, for example, been able to listen to Lisa or Joyce or Ella?
Oh, she has been listening. She has. Yeah. And she's kind of glad that it's been put up. You've put it up on your show, because people just know it's so... they know so little about it. Like, if you talk to people,
it was in the context of the election, and that's where Paula contacted us. She's in this facility, Lowe's Bridges, which, as far as I can see, looking at all the calls that there's been, I know any facility dealing with mental issues can never guarantee 100% success, never. But this Lowe's Bridges seems to be, I know it's private and very expensive, 3,000 a week, but it seems to have, in terms of people who've been through it, a very, very good response. Lisa, I'm afraid to ask you, in one sense, what would you say to the doctor who told Maureen and Paula, go home and eat chocolate and ice cream?
Oh, well, it's been said to me, Joe, as well.
By
a beloved GP who I still love dearly.
Okay,
But they just don't know what to say to you. I mean, that GP has been seeing me since I was very young, and he knows I've struggled with my eating disorder, and he knows how funny I am. And you see, I like to make loads of really funny jokes, because I find that pulls me through the awfulness, the misery, the lack of sleep, and upsetting everyone over something so silly, like whether it be a piece of bread or feeling, you know, just particularly bad about myself that day. And, you know, humour is what pulls me through. And when the doctors would say stupid things like that to me back, I'd say equally stupid things back to them, you know, like, because it's of no importance. Food isn't the issue. It's the coping strategy. And the more you tangle the daughters or whoever has the eating disorder, even men with eating disorders, the food, you're forgetting what's outside that.
That's
and you're just focusing on the symptom. You're not focusing on the problem. That's just the symptom. The problem is whatever has gone on, whether it be bullying, whether it be, I don't know what has happened previously, whether it be stress, depression, whatever has triggered it, because that's all it is. It's a symptom of the thing I've discovered the biggest in my life. And now, from going through what I've gone through, I have discovered my weaknesses and my strengths. And that's the other thing with depression. There is so much shame. You feel so embarrassed. You feel very weak. You don't feel strong enough. You don't feel like your peers. You don't feel like you've achieved as much as they should achieve. You feel like you wasted so much time on something that offered so little. And you're wasting your youth on something that will never give you back what you're putting into it. It's like having a relationship with a really horrible, dysfunctional boyfriend who's continuously beating you up. It's like that. Because that's all it does. It just... takes everything from you. It drains your world of colour. It does. And then when you start to get glimpses of it back, yeah, it's amazing. And that's what you should focus on. If you're feeling really down today and you're listening to this and you haven't eaten a sort, and you're thinking about how many calories you've had today and how many calories you can allow for your next meal, you need to think of how many calories could you have to go and do something fun with, to go and spend some time with a friend, to go and spend some time with a nephew or a dog. Dogs are great. Unconditional love. Yeah. Animals are amazing. They put up with so much and they love you regardless, and they give you so much back. And if you look at all those facets, or music, to dance around to the kitchen stupidly to some music.
That you just will. To go back into the depression thing, depression is such a cruel, devious, evil illness. It'll tell you, and like your broken arm, the minute you have your broken arm, you try and you know you are healing, please God. But depression will tell you, you can't do anything about me. I'm sorry, you can't do anything about me. And it's that thing. But it's to try and remind people, as Lisa is, and Maureen and Paula, that people do get better. I know it's a really, the way I'm saying it, probably very vacuous, but I'm hearing from Lisa that people do get better. People do beat this. But they need help.
They need help.
I'm sure if we went through all the ministers for health over the last 10 years, there were quite a few. I'm sure every one of them has said, we're going to put more money into eating disorders. So I don't know who people can trust.
I think a great idea would be, there are amazing colleges in Cork and in UL that facilitate sports science, right? And if you got a load of them to look into eating disorders, there is huge amounts of eating disorders in sports, in regards to jockeys, in regards to runners, gymnastics. And if you got them to do a case study and recovery and on eating disorders, on various refeeding syndromes, etc., and you looked at what was the best strategy, and they used that information, the government did, to put it into a treatment facility that offered better outcomes than what is currently being done now. And like you said, would save money in the long run.
With my group that I started, I started a group for families, which anybody's free to contact. It's called Parent Action and Care Group, to support a group for families, so they can pick up the phone. And they can rant and rave at me because I understand where they're coming from. Whereas if they spoke to somebody else in the street that didn't know what eating disorders were like, they would say, God, you've been so cruel to your daughter or your son because you're treating them like that.
That's so important. That's so important for mammies and for dads and for sisters to have that outlet to go and talk to, because it drains everyone in the household.
It does. I want to help other families so much, because I feel so much for what families are going through, because nobody was there for me like nobody's there for any of the rest of us. And if I can just be there at the end of the phone for people, I mean, actually inquired if there was other groups in the country, and there is no other support group for the families in this country.
Well, we know Body Wise have been around a long time. They're great. Their helpline is open 2 hours a day, 6 days a week. We put it up on their phone numbers at 0120 7906. Now I want to bring Ulrika in. Ulrika, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, how are you?
Good. And tell us, Ulrika, just to begin with, you say you're recovering anorexic. What state help did you get when you had this condition, Ulrika?
I used to get brought in for like weekly weigh-ins and stuff. Now I was younger then, I was 15, 16, and my mum realised I wasn't eating my food and the weight was coming off me. I started like dissing me dinners and eating breadsticks and stuff, you know. I'm trying to keep cutting calories each day. She realised then that I had a problem, and brought me to a counsellor. And the counsellor did weekly weigh-in sessions with me, and then referred me to the Matter Children. And when I went in there, I got a letter. My mum handed me the letter straight away, and it was, we diagnosed Ulrika with anorexia nervosa. And I was in denial. I didn't think. I looked at my mum. She cried and looked at me and said, yeah baby, you do have anorexia. So I was in denial through the whole process of me becoming anorexic. But my mum, she spotted straight away, and she done everything in her power. And like that other woman said there, like she had no help. She didn't know anybody that had anorexia before to ask the parents how they got through with it, you know. So she was on her own doing it all. She's been my rock still to this day, still cooks my food for my bodybuilding and helps me, pushes me through it, you know. So if it wasn't for her and bodybuilding, I wouldn't be here. Like,
well, explain
the services here is ridiculous.
Explain the bodybuilding, Eureka.
I actually, my sister started doing personal training. And she was like, oh, are you coming to the gym? And I'm looking at myself, like, size, I was smaller than a zero, like, I was skin and bone. And I was like, why would I need to go to the gym? You know, I'm fine. And never thought of anything. And she brought me and seeing some girl with a six-pack, and I was like, I want that. You have to eat for that now, you know that. You know, she was telling me this, that, and I was like, she's only trying to make me fat, this, that, and the other. So anyways, I seen a girl, and she was actually a bodybuilding competitor. And I was speaking to her, and she was saying, I have a competition coming up, and I just seen the six-pack, and I was dazed by it. I want that. I want that. So in the gym, endless hours a day, and train, and my food wasn't going in, so my body wasn't changing at all, you know. I don't even know how I had the energy to do it, to train. But eventually then I met this fella, and he helped me. He trained with me and promised me if he put me on this plan, that's fine. Like, he's a trainer. He was training in the gym 3 and 4 times a day, and he helped me with it and through my first competition and prepped me, brought me right up to it. I was like, I promise you, I won't make you fat. And he's the only person to this day I still trust with my field plan. I wouldn't trust anybody else with it, you know. But it was hard. There was I had a few relapses. It wasn't just, oh, you want to be a bodybuilder, here's your plan on the bandwagon. It wasn't like that. I had relapses. It was hard. I cried. I seen myself putting on weight. I always measured by my hands, so my hands didn't fit around my thigh. I knew I'd put on weight, and I cut back the field again. So it was a vicious circle, and it kept going and going and going. But I think once I'd done my first competition, that was it. Like, the fire lit in my belly, and I knew that's what I wanted to be. Like,
and you found something that gave you a passion, and Did you ever, when you were in the throes of anorexia, did you ever have to go private, as they say, Ulrika?
I did. My mum brought me private to a few people, and, you know, speaking, and it cost hundreds each visit. But they'd never get out now. I mean, I was just too stubborn. Even on my weigh-ins, when I used to get weighed in, I used to drink loads of water, put phones in my pocket, wear about 4 pairs of bottoms, just so my weight would be up. And then they told me if I didn't put on 5 pounds by the following day, I'd be hospitalised, and my mum couldn't do anything about it because I was a minor. So my mum was like, this is out of my hands now. So you're going into the hospital if you don't put this on by tomorrow. I said, get me a KFC. I ate the KFC and I was riddled with the pain. My stomach, you know, just trying to open up my stomach. But I put on the weight I needed to put on, and then I went backwards again. It was just so I wouldn't get hospitalised. It was the only reason. So I was freaking the doctors, you know.
Say with us, Joyce, Ulrika, Lisa, Maureen, Jane, 51551 1850, 715815.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
And Joe at RT.ie. Caroline, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. How are you, Joe?
How are you, Caroline? Are you phoning from the States?
No, I'm not, actually. No,
I returned
to Ireland, yeah.
And your story is you were diagnosed with anorexia or an eating disorder when?
I don't even know what age I was. I was so bad at the time, but I think I was about 16, I think. Yeah, 15, 16. Yeah. And at the time, they really didn't know what it was. I mean, they had a name for it, but and I don't remember the hospital my mother brought me to or even why, the circumstances around it, but obviously I had lost a lot of weight. And so I have vague memories of being weighed and all that kind of stuff and then being sent home. And my mother, I suppose, was given directions to feed me up, and all I remember really is having to drink a glass of milk with my dinner, which I absolutely hated. But that was really the first diagnosis. I didn't know what it was. My parents had no idea what it was. They were absolutely mortified, and consequently I was mortified. It then went from anorexia into bulimia, which absolutely I didn't know what to do with myself. I was so guilt-ridden and so ashamed, and just was frantic. And of course, you know, had found obviously the ways to get around having to eat, and it just spiraled out of control. It just was, it was awful. It was the most awful time in my life, and of which I have very few memories, I think, because I was so undernourished.
Wow.
So I applaud that young woman. I'm sorry, I didn't get
Lisa,
to hear the whole show.
Well, Lisa and Ulrika.
And I didn't get to hear everybody's story, but anybody coming out of it.
And how did you come out of it, Caroline? Is that a fair way? Or you said, do you regard yourself as recovering, so to speak?
I would say I'm recovered. But it's always the back of my mind. Okay. It's always there. I watch everything I put into my mouth. I exercise, given my age, you know, my body's changing shape whether I want it or not, no matter what I do. So, but the only way for me was I actually had left the country, partly because I couldn't cope with what was going on with me. And I thought, you know, I'll go away. It'll get better. Everything would be great. Of course, it didn't. And I couldn't actually cope. I was working, had a great job in the States, but I couldn't actually cope. My life started to literally fall down around me. And I'd had a couple of seizures, which nobody knew, could pinpoint why. I knew they had to be related to this undernourished state that I was in. Mm-hmm. And eventually I thought, I have to do something because I'm not going to survive. I had really thoughts of suicide. I had, I was in a very, very bad place, totally isolated on my own, talking to myself. I mean, literally, you know, people say you drive yourself mad. I was. And so finally, I just thought, I have to do something. And I remember looking up what was it about? What was anorexia? What was bulimia? Yeah. I remember then looking for a psychiatrist or a psychologist who could help me, and found somebody who specialized in eating disorders. Now, we're talking about almost 40 years ago. So I think I was probably lucky to find him. And that was kind of the start of a long road back to any kind of normal life. I was, I think, 24, maybe 26 around by then.
And you say you went to the States. Was that...
Yeah.
Was that a reaction?
I couldn't cope. I couldn't cope what was going on here, and it was an opportunity that presented itself, so I took the opportunity. Of course, it wasn't any better over there. I came back then after a short time because I was lonely, miserable. I was staying with an aunt, but I was just couldn't really get to grips with it. Thought I'd be fine coming home. I could handle it. Everything was different. I was older, but ended up going away again 2 years later, again with the same flight. You know, I have to get out of here. Again, thinking I'll make it better. I'll be better this time. And besides, I needed to stay away for 2 years and all the rest of it. And, you know, and then eventually, as I said, when I was 26, ended up finding this psychologist who eventually, you know, started to help me and get me back on the path. But it's lifelong. It really is. And it's very difficult. And I think it's still not fully understood, though it's come an awful long way. It's awful to hear that there isn't a lot of support in Ireland for it, because it's obviously widespread.
We would have thought that, given that anorexia has been spoken about for such a long time. I take your point, Caroline, that when you were first diagnosed, it wasn't all that well. But that we would have come further than three beds in a hospital, ring-fenced as a HSE. Now, I know they say you can apply for help in private, one of the few, very few private facilities. But as we're hearing, that's what prompted the initial call. Families are finding it, despite promises made by politicians 2 years ago, are finding it very, very hard to access that help made by different politicians at different times, but primarily in the last few years, obviously, by Fine Gael. Stay with us, Caroline, Ulrika, Lisa and others, Joyce and Jane. We'll be back after this. 51551.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
51551. We're talking about promises made and promises broken, real lives, real people. Sheila Nocton, that sounds patronising, I didn't mean it that way. Sheila, good afternoon, but it's in reaction to all the stuff I'm hearing from politicians non-stop, not every day, everywhere, non-stop. Sheila Nocton, Sheila, good afternoon.
Hi Joe, how are you?
Now, to come back to where this began, which was a caller 2 days ago from a facility, it's a mental health facility, but it's for eating disorders. And she pointed out that so far her family have scrimped and borrowed, and I don't think they've had to beg, I hope they haven't to beg, to pay the €25,000, which is the facility, which, by the way, is called Lowest Bridge, and nobody, as far as I know, has complained about it so far. They say, everyone says it's highly staffed, highly trained and well run. And it comes on then where the likes of Joyce is coming through with actual quotes from the Taoiseach 2 years ago, saying, we will deal with your kid, with your daughter's case, Danielle, as she's named, with urgency, and nothing happened. Now, Sheila, what just begin in terms of the support you got, and then I'll move into your own situation.
Yeah, so I suppose it was back 2017, really, when things became apparent for me, and I ended up, I've had support, I've been in St. Pat's Hospital twice. Inpatient on two occasions, and then 6 months of outpatient care until I recently, well, in the past few months, got a letter to say I was no longer part of their services because, I've moved away. I haven't been able to attend any appointments because I've moved from Wicklow to Monaghan. So, but now, great family support. We had to go, obviously, private. It was tough.
And what's your situation now, Sheila?
So I suppose in terms of what we've heard already, my situation isn't hugely different. I didn't realise how sick I was. Worst time of my life. Didn't know, my brain wasn't functioning properly because I was just so underweight. And I eventually had to be brought from my house in Dublin back home by my parents, even if whether I wanted it or not. I struggled to get my first appointment. If we had waited to when my first appointment had been scheduled, I probably wouldn't have survived. Probably would have been dead. So
well, the appointment was so far down the road.
Yeah, I asked for an appointment in June. I was told the first appointment I could get was October. My dad eventually rang and said, I won't have a daughter if you don't give me an appointment sooner.
Yeah.
So we fought and we got an earlier appointment, and I was actually, funny enough, discharged by the time my first appointment should have been. Now, I ended up back in because, as you've heard there, things can get worse, things do get worse, sometimes before they ever get better. But since then, and I was told, by the way, in my recovery, I shouldn't work, shouldn't make big decisions, but actually finding a job that I love and moving away has saved my life more than the services have. And that's not to say that Pat's was awful or anything. It's just the support isn't good enough and there isn't enough of it.
And what supports do you have now, Sheila?
Yeah, I suppose that's the thing. It still upsets me now because I've moved from Wicklow up to Monaghan, where we hear all the time about how rural Ireland doesn't have the same facilities as everywhere else. But I don't think till you experience it and you're living with it in the area that you realise that it's so true. Firstly, I can't get a doctor here. There's no GP services. I haven't had my bloods taken in months. I haven't had it taken in a year, really, since I moved here, because I can't get a doctor and I work midweek. How will I get to a doctor? So I don't know. I used to have anemia. I probably still do. I don't know. I could be tired. I don't know why. I can't get to a doctor to ask them if I'm having problems with, because you put your body through hell. There's a lot of health complications afterwards. I don't know how to address them. I can't ask a doctor. I don't have a therapist. My therapist was down, private therapist, was down in at home. I don't know how to get down to her. I don't know who to go to here. And I look around and all I see is a mental health service in Monaghan town that is only somewhat functioning. I see people walking around and I know, looking at them, that they need help. And I don't even know where to tell them to go, because even things like that help me down at home, like body-wise, they're not as evident up here. I feel like I look better, but I don't know where, when my head isn't feeling as healthy as my body looks, I don't know what to do. And I feel that that's the same for an awful lot of people. But thankfully, I got the weight back up before I came up here.
But Sheila, surely you can get blood tests. Just walk into a hospital and...
Yeah, I suppose that's the thing. You have to go to hospital, and then you're waiting, or you're told about the problems in emergency departments. I know up here, Cavan, they were asking people not to come to the emergency department, not to come into the hospital. They didn't have the staff. Like, it's knock-on effects of other things that are happening within the health system that means that we just can't get the help. And, you know, my family are great, but they're 2 hours away, and... At the same time, I don't want to leave here, because if I didn't have this job and wasn't doing what I loved, I don't think my head would be in such a good position.
Yeah.
It's so tough. I just don't know what anybody who... I regularly have parents contacting me because I'm quite outspoken about the fact that I've been unwell. Mm-hmm. And they say, well, where do I send my child? And I say, well, you have to go to the doctor and you have to... And there is... But it's going to be a long process. And it shouldn't be that long. Because we're going to die. That's the only way to and that's not being dramatic. People are going to continue dying if they don't get the services quickly.
Okay, well, listen to Paul. Stay there, Sheila and Lisa. Paula, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
How did you get help for your daughter with an eating disorder?
We had to fight through the courts to get my daughter over to London. Wow. Because we were told here as an adult that there was nothing more that they could do for her here.
And how did you end up in court, Paula?
She was under the mental health order.
Yeah.
So she was automatically, I suppose, cared for by the courts. Mm-hmm. And there was nothing here. And we said we wanted...
There was no facility for dealing with eating disorders.
There was no facilities for dealing with eating disorders. As you heard over the last couple of days, there's three eating disorder public health beds in Ireland.
We're told by the HUD, they're ring-fenced in St Vincent's Hospital.
There are three of them for all of Ireland. And if you listen to the research, there's over 200,000 people in Ireland with eating disorders.
God.
And Sarah McDavitt is doing... as much work as she can for children and adolescents. It's still not enough, but every patient is entitled to be cared for. And if the HSE if the HSE can't provide a public health service, those mental health patients should be entitled to, just like every other patient who has to wait to get a service someplace else.
But how did you end up in court? Like, that was a big risk, surely.
Well, we ended up in court because she was that unwell.
And you decided, you initiated a court action?
No, she was in hospital, and because she was so unwell and she didn't want care, her consultant went to the court to take her under so that she had to be looked after whether she wanted herself or not.
Okay.
And with that...
But you're saying you had to go to court to get the state to provide treatment?
Yes, because her consultant refused to give her a referral letter.
And you won in court, obviously. It's a wrong word to use, but you were successful in court in getting your daughter transferred to the UK.
Yes.
And did that make a difference?
Yes, she's still alive today. Otherwise, she would be dead.
Okay. Caroline, Paula, Lisa, Sheila, and a whole queue of people on this incredibly important issue. 51551, we'll be back after this. Thank you all.